Good morning. This is Focus 580, our morning telephone talk show. My name is Jack Brighton, sitting in for David Inge today and the rest of the week. Glad you could listen. During this hour of the program, we will be talking with Gerald Adelman. He is an open space activist and historic preservationist and founder of the Illinois and Michigan Canal National Heritage Corridor. He's also executive director of the Open Lands Project of Illinois. These are two nonprofit organizations working within Illinois to preserve open space and do a variety of historic preservation sorts of things. In 1998, Jerry Adelman was appointed by the Secretary of the Interior to serve as a commissioner on the INM Canal National Heritage Corridor Commission. We'll talk a bit about that. He's also a member of the Illinois Nature Preserves Commission, an emeritus member of the National Board of Advisors of the National Trust for Historic Preservation, and has served on the boards of numerous civic organizations. He's in town here to give a lecture in the Millicom series, and that will be at 7:30 tonight at the Levis Faculty Center on the third floor. And he'll be talking about the topic, or the title is, What is a Landscape for? Smart Growth and Livability in 21st Century. And we'll talk about that, a variety of other issues. He's also played a key role in establishing the Midowin National Tallgrass Prairie, something that we might want to touch on during the hour. But we'll also be happy to take your questions. If you'd like to join the conversation, you can call us around Champaign-Urbana at 333-9455. That's 333-WILL, if you match the letters with the numbers. We also have a toll-free line anywhere you hear us, 800-222-9455. Again, around Champaign-Urbana, 333-WILL. Elsewhere, 800-222-WILL. Jerry Adelman, good morning.
Good morning, Jack.
Thanks for being here.
It's great to be here.
Maybe I could ask you to talk, just to start, about the Open Lands Project.
Sure. Open Lands Project is a regional land conservation group. Mm-hmm. We were formed 38 years ago. And one of the first in the country really focused on a metropolitan area. At that time in particular, people felt there was very little worth saving, you know, in a city or suburbs or kind of exurban fringe. Conservation was seen as out there, wilderness, rural areas. But we've been working in Chicago and throughout the broader metropolitan region as advocates for public open space. Many sites we've provided a lot of leadership for, often working in partnership, such as the first example of a conversion of an abandoned railroad to a right-of-way, the Illinois Prairie Path, or Volo Bog, Goose Lake Prairie. You know, there's a long list of sites that we were directly involved in saving, the largest being the Midowin National Tallgrass Prairie, but also get involved very much in public policy, public education, about issues related to land conservation and land use and planning, and increasingly have been at the table with others in these discussions around smart growth, if you want, you know, sort of how we're growing as a region and what the implications are for the environment as well as for our economy and quality of life.
We'll certainly get into that, but just to follow up on the projects that you've been working on, for example, the Tallgrass Prairie at the former Joliet Arsenal. I mean, these are sites, these particular sites are formerly heavily developed, and you're looking at ways to reuse those sites, essentially. Is that correct?
Yes. We often deal with abandoned sites that had uses, sometimes brownfield kind of sites.
Yeah.
That's especially true in a lot of our inner city community greening efforts. With the Midowin, it was a huge property put together right at the outbreak of World War II, and basically was composed of farms, dozens and dozens of farms that the federal government acquired. They wanted a site to manufacture TNT that was far enough removed from the coast so it was protected, close enough to a large metropolitan area that they had the labor force, but not so close that if there were explosions that you could have major disasters. And so the 24,000 acres that remained initially was larger, but under the Nixon administration, some of that land was deaccessioned. But when they finally closed it down in the mid-1990s, 24,000 acres remained. Only about 3,000 of them had industrial uses, however, so basically it was pasture land. Mm-hmm. And functioned, even though it wasn't pristine virgin prairie. In fact, there were only a few prairie remnants, But because they were grasslands, very important habitat for grassland birds. And so Tony Hiss, for instance, the environmental writer, has said that this is the first 22nd century national park, because it's going to take 100 years to kind of restore the ecosystems, but already plays a very important role as habitat. And it's just this huge expanse of open space. You know, Illinois, the prairie state, and yet we have less than 0.1% of that original prairie that survives. And so we felt here was a great opportunity, close to where 8 million people live, to bring prairie back and to really provide a unique opportunity for residents of the region and state, and the nation for that matter.
Do you want to also talk a little bit about the Canal Corridor Association?
Sure. Canal Corridor Association grew out of Open Lands Project in 1982. Open Lands had provided earlier leadership focused more narrowly on the canal proper. And this is a little tow canal that was built in the 1830s and 40s to connect Lake Michigan at Chicago with the Illinois River at La Salle, Peru, cutting through a low continental divide, bridging these two major drainages. You know, the Chicago River originally emptied into Lake Michigan, was part of the Great Lakes drainage to the Atlantic Ocean, whereas the Illinois River, you know, is part of the Mississippi down to the Gulf of Mexico. So this canal bridged those and really gave birth to Chicago and to the communities along it. It was replaced in the 1920s and 30s with subsequent waterways and other transportation systems, and sections of the canal remained in state ownership. And in 1970s, 60 miles of it was designated a state park. But they cut off the northern section close to Chicago, in part because it was fragmented. And we started looking at the broader landscape, not just at the little canal and its right-of-way, but at the river valley and the towns and kind of mosaic of land uses, and recognize that there's just extraordinary landscape here that really told a story of the growth and development of the upper Midwest and still contained, you know, fabulous natural and cultural resources, and that somehow if that could all be woven together, it could create the equivalent, if you want, of a national park at Chicago's backyard. And so Canal Corridor Association was formed to really provide leadership for that. And we were successful in 1984 in getting the region designated the first of its kind in the country, a National Heritage Corridor, mm-hmm. kind of a partnership park, if you want, where the federal government actually doesn't own and manage any of the resources, or very few. They have the Madewin, which is, in fact, is the centerpiece now. Mm-hmm. But where it's state and local government with private interests, and it's very much an effort to improve the region as it is to preserve it, you know, a combination of both and trying to develop a shared sense of the future, a vision, if you want, for that region. So we get involved in downtown revitalization. We have we had the first Main Street program, for instance, in Illinois, which now is a statewide program. We had partnered with the National Trust on that in a pilot initiative, trying to revitalize these historic downtowns and waterfronts. Been working to develop a trail system. We now have 80 miles of hiking and biking trails. Provided kind of a regional context for a lot of the conservation and preservation work, saving important prairie remnants and other natural resources. And using the cultural natural resources really as the framework, you know, for revitalization efforts, especially focused on heritage or cultural tourism, thinking of the 8 million people who live in and near Chicago who maybe want to learn about their own history and experience the outdoors and visit some of these wonderful sites, the state parks and forest preserves and historic sites that are located along this 100-mile route.
Mm-hmm. I think a lot of people are very interested in this type of thing happening in their communities. You know, and we look at historic buildings, many of which are in disrepair and so forth. And, you know, a lot of times sort of feel helpless that, you know, there are all these assets the community has. How do you go about addressing that and actually, you know, making some kind of forward progress in developing the resources that, you know, the community has? I mean, you mentioned it's sort of a partnership approach.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think the use of asset is a good term that often, especially in an area like the I&M Canal region back in the early 80s when this was first being conceived and developed as a concept, there were pretty bleak times. This was the Rust Belt. a tremendous amount of disinvestment, high levels of unemployment. For instance, Joliet, which is the largest city outside of Chicago along the 100-mile corridor, had 25% unemployment. And so people were focusing on the negative things, you know. And we stepped in and said, yeah, that's true, but, you know, you also have extraordinary assets. And the first thing that we did was bring together scholars representing different disciplines to help us really inventory, you know, what was really there. We found that we had the largest collection of natural areas, for instance, in the state of Illinois, these remnants of the original Illinois landscape, in part because it was an industrial and transportation corridor. Large areas were kind of cut off and inaccessible and undeveloped, and so these wonderful prairie and wetland remnants and forested areas survived. In terms of the historic and cultural resources, it was just a gold mine, you know, from early Native American culture through the French period, the fur trade, you know, right up to the present with the permanent European settlement and establishment of towns and birthplace of the Industrial Revolution in our part of the country. And so there were all these wonderful buildings and sites and recreational opportunities. And so we started reaching out to the public and kind of telling that story, trying to reconnect people to the land. And I think that created a climate then where people were open to new ideas. How do you actually then save a building or restore a downtown or protect a prairie? There's no kind of formula, I guess. It starts, though, with local support and awareness. Without that, there's not the political will. And then we really tried to draw upon any resource we could find. You know, if there was a grant program or a state or national organization that offered technical help, turning to, you know, chambers of commerce and to the business community and grassroots groups. And so each success story kind of has its own set of players and own unique kind of elements. But I think, again, it starts, though, with the people who live there, not just in the community but in the broader region, recognizing what they have, articulating its value somehow, and making sure then that that voice is heard as change takes place. Certainly, there's an economic dimension to it, a bottom line value, and I think we're finding that reusing historic buildings and historic downtowns and areas where investments had been made, where there's good public transit often, various kinds of infrastructure investments that were made over the years, that there's a logic to reusing, you know, rather than discarding. But it's not just a bottom line argument, obviously. But I think that's one of the things that was in our favor, that there was a growing awareness nationally about the economics of reuse, if you want, and also about the importance of quality of life when you're talking about economic development activity. It's not just, you know, where are the good roads and utilities and so forth, but can you attract the kind of employees and personnel, and what do you have to offer? I mean, obviously things like good schools, but also is it a community that has a local pride, a sense of place, some unique cultural and recreational opportunities? You're competing with regions around the country. And so I think a lot of these things got woven into a strategy that has many dimensions to it and obviously continues onto the present. You know, it's sort of a process that never ends.
We have a call to talk with. Let's include them in our conversation. I'll mention again our guest during this hour, Focus 580, is Jerry Edelman. He's executive director of the Open Lands Project and president of the Canal Corridor Association in Illinois. And he'll be speaking tonight in the Millicom Lecture Series. It's at 7:30 p.m. at Levis Faculty Center on the third floor. And calls are welcome if you'd like to join our conversation. 333-9455 around Champaign-Urbana. Anywhere else, 800-222-9455. We'll go first to a listener in Belgium on line number 4. Good morning. You're on Focus 580.
Hello. I'm not altogether sure if my comments are probably appropriate for here, seeing that you really seem to be talking more about what's going on today instead of just what's the canal systems. But what the topic I was going to touch on for you was there's a failed canal that came through western Indiana called the Wabash and Erie Canal that failed just as the railroads came through. I'm not sure that it was totally built. It was supposed to go down to Vincennes, but I may very well have stopped short of that because the western expansion of the railroads overdid it. Okay. But it's still available to look at, and people who know about it along the western edge of Indiana along the Wabash River, there are many areas where it's still there. There's canal systems, there's water impoundments where they used to use it, various things like that. When it got along the Wabash from all pretty close to Lafayette, there were spots of it. It went around all the various rapids that are in the Wabash River and cut off the loops and stuff. Did you folks ever deal with that part of the canal system?
No, our focus really has been exclusively on the Illinois and Michigan Canal. Obviously, we're aware of the great canal building era of the 19th century and some of the other canals, and there are, you know, efforts really across the country to preserve and enhance the remaining canals as amenities and as important cultural artifacts and important linear elements for recreational opportunities. But it's interesting you point out the relationship between the canals and the railroad. In fact, our canal here in Illinois was proposed actually initially in the 17th century when Marquette and Joliet came through after discovering the Mississippi. Their Indian guides suggested a shortcut. It took them through this region, and they recognized that, you know, by cutting a canal through this continental divide and bridging these two major water systems, two drainages, that you know, you could have continuous water travel all the way from the Atlantic to the Gulf of Mexico. And it had been talked about. President Madison, for instance, in his inaugural address, pointed out this canal as one of the most important internal improvements that the new nation could enter into. But debates ensued, finally, in the state legislature, and there were advocates for the new railroad versus the canal. And it was, in fact, Abraham Lincoln who became, as state legislator, the principal advocate for a canal. He said it was much more democratic. He said that the moguls of industry, you know, controlled the railroads, and anyone could put their boat in the canal and use it. So it was interesting, you know, and many people said, well, gee, the canal opened in 1848, and the canal was then paralleled by railroads a few years later, which is true, and it put it out of business. Well, that's not true. In fact, the heaviest tonnage shipped on the I&M Canal was in the 1880s. And so both the railroad and the canal kind of brought in more development and industrial activity along this corridor. But many of the canals, you know, were outmoded quickly, and most of them did not pay for themselves, the two notable exceptions being the Erie and the I&M.
Well, only a portion of the Erie. Not all of the Erie paid for itself. This portion down here did not really.
No, I meant not the Wabash and Erie, but yeah. Just the Erie Canal in New York State.
Yeah. And it's interesting that you would bring up Lincoln, because in this area where Champaign-Urbana, this area where we're at over here in Danville area, on over to Springfield, Lincoln traveled this area, and most of his court cases that he dealt with, or a large percentage of them that he dealt with railroad right-of-ways.
Right, and of course, then he was the attorney for the Illinois Central as well. So, ironically,
advocate the canals.
Well, I think he really did feel that you know, it was a much more equitable way that to make a public investment, and he was really concerned that you know, the railroads would be controlled by a handful of people. Ironically, then that's how he made his own
living
and whatever, and became the spokesperson for the railroads. So interesting history, though, and the canal building era, you know, of the United States is one that I think has generated a lot of interest and lore, and we're seeing a revival of interest in canals, you know, throughout the eastern part of the United States.
The unfortunate part about the canals over here along the western edge of Indiana is that none of them are at all viable. There's very little water or just standing water in them now.
Well, that's the situation with our I&M, too. Of course, it's paralleled by the Sanitary and Ship Canal up in the Chicago region, and then in the 1920s, and finished in 1933 is the Illinois Waterway, which parallels it. But the actual I&M, only sections are watered. So in many cases, it's treated as a greenway, if you want, a linear park for hiking and biking. But there are no canal boats, for instance. We're hoping to establish kind of a canal boat museum and some working canal boats at the terminus in LaSalle. And that's a project that is in its infancy right now, but that's generating a lot of enthusiasm and we hope political support.
Thank you very much.
Sure.
Thanks very much for the call. There are many things you can do with these canals, and besides, you know, put water in them.
That's right.
As you mentioned.
And, you know, it's interesting that the impetus for the preservation of the canal really came from the people who live in the communities mm-hmm. that border it. They realized that it gave birth to their towns. The northern section of the canal was excluded from the state park designation in 1974 because it was fragmented, because many sections were dry. The state had leased the adjacent lands to industry, and so it couldn't function as a traditional linear park. But people in communities like Joliet and Lockport and Lamont and Willow Springs, Summit, they kept coming back to Open Lands Project, this fairly new advocacy organization, say, you know, help us with our little piece of the canal. And they said, by the way, there's also a wonderful wet prairie, and there's this forested area, and there's significant habitat down the river valley. And so that's when Open Lands started looking more broadly at the regional landscape and said, well, maybe a traditional linear park along the canal wasn't feasible because of the fragmentation. But by looking at this broader landscape, this ancient transportation corridor, one could piece together a mosaic of open spaces and cultural sites had in some ways even greater significance than just the canal in isolation. But I think that, you know, the canal, there's a certain drama and lore and mystery to it, and people are just fascinated, you know, by life, 19th century life on a canal. So even when you don't have the watered canal, you just have the right of way, I mean, it can still be an artifact that triggers, that kind of investigation and public education, and certainly functions as a wonderful linear park and public open space.
It sounds like what you're talking about is, in essence, a community-wide effort to look at the landscape in a given area, and perhaps that could be, you know, a county-wide area, and attempt to do some kind of planning for the needs of the community, whether it be, you know, commerce, recreation, habitat, etc.
Exactly. And in fact, there's a piece of legislation that Open Lands Project has been instrumental in crafting and supporting that's before the Illinois legislature right now, which is called the Local Legacy Program. Representative Dave Winters from Rockford has introduced the bill. And this would provide financial support and technical assistance for counties who partner with their municipalities to, first of all, inventory their special places, their cultural and natural resources, as well as identifying prime farmland that they want to protect as agricultural zones. With that inventory in hand, then develop a comprehensive resource protection plan, again with financial and technical help from the state. With the plan, then, they would qualify for new sources of financial support for preservation, acquisition of conservation easements, fee simple acquisition, and so forth. It's a modest effort, but it's moving, we think, in the right direction. Right now, the way Illinois is structured, decisions are made pretty much in a piecemeal fashion. Municipalities, their zoning and planning supersedes the county. And so often they're working at cross purposes. And we feel that it starts again with this kind of broader consensus building to make sure that there's predictability here. I mean, it works for the developer as well as for the conservationist, because up front, you know, people have gone through the efforts to identify that which is special and that ought to be protected. And everyone knows then, you know, it's not sort of an 11th hour battle with the bulldozer sort of in front of the building or in the prairie and people trying to stop it. And I think that this whole heritage area movement, we were the first National Heritage Corridor, this kind of partnership park designated by Congress. Mm-hmm. There are now 23 of them. They're called heritage areas because not all of them are linear. Many do follow canals and other transportation corridors, but some, like America's Industrial Heritage in Pennsylvania, in fact, is 8 counties. And it's where the iron and steel industry was concentrated, and its goal is to really tell that story of labor history and of industrialization. So it follows along the lines that you suggested, you know, a whole county, in this case 8 counties, sort of get coming together, all different levels of government and private sector to, craft kind of a park proposal, if you want, identifying the key sites and linking them through driving tours and hiking and biking routes, and then telling that story, you know, through creative ways, curriculum in the schools, brochures, site interpretation, and so forth.
Mm-hmm. And having a plan for development with these assets in place.
Exactly. And using the assets as assets, as ways to help shape new development. You know, here in Champaign-Urbana, you know, go to the Strip, you know, or anywhere else in Illinois or United States. And if you were dropped from outer space, I mean, the only thing that would be different from one Strip development to another, in most cases, is the vegetation. If you're in Florida, you might have palm trees. Here you'll have deciduous trees if you have any, and so forth. These are anonymous landscapes. I mean, they tell us nothing about the unique history of the place or the character, personality of the community. Mm-hmm. And I think Americans are really troubled by that. And so by focusing, again, on the cultural landscape and the natural landscape and identifying those features that are special and unique to your area, they not only are preserved if you have a good plan, but they hopefully can help trigger development that responds to it, that becomes a little more place-based, that has this sense of place and rootedness and isn't just, you know, some sort of anonymous plan that a chain has developed and is applied anywhere equally throughout the country.
We're a little past our midpoint. We're talking this morning during this hour, Focus 580, with Jerry Adelman, Executive Director of the Open Lands Project. He's also President of the Canal Corridor Association in Illinois. And he'll be speaking at 7:30 tonight on the third floor of Levis Faculty Center on smart growth and livability in the 21st century. We'll welcome your phone calls for the rest of the hour. If you'd like to join our conversation, you can do so by calling us at 333-9455 around Champaign-Urbana. Anywhere else, 800-222-9455. What you were just describing seems like a very rosy and positive scenario, as opposed to the case in a lot of instances where growth just seems to happen. You know, we were talking earlier before the show started about how around Chicago, the collar counties are just exploding in population and development. And you mentioned something about how even a small gain in population might result in a huge increase in actual physical development, with the, you know, effect on the landscape along with that.
Exactly. For instance, from 1970 to 1990, in the six-county Chicago metropolitan area, there was only a 4% increase in population. During that same 20-year period, there was a 46% increase in developed land. To give another little time frame, from 1950 to 1998, there was a 46% increase in population, 165% increase in developed land. So what we're seeing is lower density, sprawl patterns of development, very harmful to the environment, obviously. We're using prime farmland and developing wonderful natural resources, leapfrogging, going further and further out, away from public investment, from public service, from schools, and the kind of infrastructure that and support systems that community needs, while we're abandoning inner city neighborhoods and older suburbs. Now, the recent census reports were somewhat hopeful relative to Chicago. For the first time since 1950, there was actually a slight increase in population. And that's very positive and quite wonderful. But in the big picture, with the huge growth in the collar counties, older suburbs are still losing population, many of them. We're seeing these patterns of disinvestment. And the thing is, it's not just an environmental impact. I would argue it's an economic impact. I mean, as a society, I don't think we can afford to support all of the kinds of infrastructure and institutional needs that we have as we're continuing to maintain the communities that we've already developed historically. So there's a real economic impact. I mean, it may be cheaper when you first move out to the new development in the cornfield, your taxes are low. But as it grows around you and you have to build the schools and new roads and the fire department and the police and whatever, your taxes are going to go up, and that's the pattern that we see. Then people move further out for cheaper housing, but it's just a vicious cycle.
Yeah.
Traffic congestion, poor air quality. I mean, these are all products, if you want, of these low-density sprawl patterns of development. But there are also, I think, some psychological and social implications, too. First of all, they are car dependent. Mm-hmm. So you get the huge residential development, you know, the huge shopping center, the office park. They aren't connected. There are no sidewalks. You can't walk from school to home to library, whatever. Mm-hmm. Both parents working. They have to drive the kids everywhere. I mean, they spend so much time in the car. Old people in particular are very isolated, you know, especially when they can't drive any longer. And young people, the two ends of the demographic, you know, spectrum. I mean, it creates a great deal of social isolation. We aren't building communities. We're doing projects. And so, you know, I would say that, you know, is it by chance or by choice? I mean, this is not just the marketplace. It isn't just public will. There are hidden subsidies here. Huge amount of federal and state money that go into the new roads and the sewer extensions and the other kinds of improvements that are necessary that make that land so cheap and the housing so relatively inexpensive on the fringe. Our federal housing policies, really dating back to the 1930s, have subsidized and provided low interest mortgages and so forth for new housing, not for rental and not for older rehab. The huge highway building after World War II, you know, across this country that led to our tollways and highways that opened up these vast areas, you know, those are subsidies. The developer doesn't pay for it, you know, but we as taxpayers pay. And so I think we have to kind of step back and really look at what are the forces that are shaping the kind of growth that we're seeing, the kind of development. And those who are involved in sensible growth or smart growth movement aren't saying no growth. It's just saying we need to rethink it and we need to be more strategic and we need to understand the implications on our ecology, our economy, and our society of the patterns that we presently have. At Open Lands Project, we did a study called Under Pressure, and we did focus groups in 13 counties in southeastern Wisconsin, northeastern Illinois, and northwestern Indiana with local officials, planners, developers, conservationists, home builders, so forth, people involved in real estate. And based on that, we came up with some forecasts. And we said that in the next 10-year period, it's likely, if we don't change the way we do business, that there will be a 55% increase in developed land, and that over the next 30 years, we will double in size. So it took us, what, over 150 years to develop the footprint that we have. Mm-hmm. That's going to double. And again, very
in
low density,
years.
Double in 30.
55%
increase in 10. No. That's not sustainable any way you cut it. And so we're hoping, you know, as more and more people start looking at what's going on around them and understand the forces that are shaping it, that we will develop some new policies and programs. States like New Jersey, Tennessee, Maryland, recently Wisconsin, and many others have passed smart growth legislation, incentive-based, you know, kind of initiatives, but that are beginning to make a difference. And I'm hopeful in Illinois that we're headed in that direction as well, although we're pretty far behind at the moment.
There seems to be another incentive going in the other direction to encourage growth, at least in many of these strip malls and you know, commercial developments that you mentioned, where a city needs the tax revenue. They need the sales tax base because they've got the schools to pay for and, you know, the fire and the infrastructure and the city to run. And there is a real competition, certainly in Illinois, among municipalities to bring in these developments, you know, a new shopping center and so forth. And what tends to happen is we've seen here in Champaign-Urbana, and I'm sure elsewhere, you'll have a large chain retail operation that builds something in what was the commercial hot area. And then as other large capital stores come in new developments, then suddenly the traffic patterns start to change out in that direction. And so the old commercial hot spots are no longer the hot spots. And so these other older stores realize, well, they have to build a bigger and newer facility in the new strip. And these large, formerly they were large, now they're larger in the new location. These older large buildings sit there unused.
You know, as you point out, it's no longer the case of the traditional 19th century downtown that's being abandoned for the new strip development. It's now the earlier generation of strip development that's being abandoned for the newer one, and now in some cases the third generation, as you point out. And what you have is annexation wars between communities for the cash-rich commercial development. We find that other than very high-end residential, residential doesn't pay for itself. So you're finding, you know, development happening without any grand scheme. You know, it's just sort of a free-for-all. We're subsidizing roads and building new roads, but we aren't addressing land use. And they've got to go together, obviously. So I think there are alternatives, and I think we're paying the price in many different ways. And there are clearly winners and losers, you know, and the winner of today will be the loser of tomorrow. And so at some point, you kind of have to say, but wait a minute, this doesn't make sense. And government is making decisions by not having policies and by subsidizing certain things or not subsidizing them that is fueling this. And so it's not simply the marketplace. The marketplace will respond to whatever the rules are, if you want. And so other states like Maryland have enacted, you know, very positive incentive-based initiatives, saying, for instance, if you want to develop in a zone outside of our growth zone, and each community defines a growth zone, not a rigid growth boundary, but a zone, that's a logical extension of existing infrastructure, sewer, water, roads, and so forth. If you want to leapfrog and go, you know, 10 miles out into the farmland, we aren't telling you you can't do it. But then don't come to us and ask for us to build a road or to build the fire station or the new school or whatever. You know, you have to pay the full cost of development. And so this is beginning to reverse a lot of those patterns in Maryland as an example. I guess the granddaddy of growth management in the United States is Oregon, and everyone points to that and says it's communism, you know. And there they have very rigid growth boundaries around every community. Mm-hmm. Again, not an anti-growth proposal. In fact, they've had the support of the home builders and the realtors. But they agree on here's a very firm line, and you cannot develop outside of that. So there are different models here, a full spectrum, and I think Illinois is going to be far closer, if we ever move in that direction, toward the Maryland model, as an example. But I do think that we have to begin to understand the hidden subsidies and the kinds of frameworks in which this is all playing out and recognize, again, that the winner of today is the loser of tomorrow. And so at some point, we just have to say we can't support this any longer.
We have another call to talk with. Let's include them in our conversation. This is a listener in Danville on line number 4. Good morning. You're on Focus 580.
Yes. You may have brought it up a little bit here just now on your talking about urban growth and stuff. But like I said, you got the do you ever run across much opposition to what you're doing? You know, we may not like what we got, but we don't want what you're selling.
Do you run into opposition to what you're trying to do is the question.
Sure. I think fear of the unknown in part and misrepresentation. What we're trying to do is engage more and more people in the dialogue, get them to the table. And so it's not just the decision of, you know, the planning commission and the city council alone, but it's the broader community. And there's some interesting tools that have been developed to provide a more kind of democratic, low-D here, you know, sort of process. And that's what it's all about. I think at this stage, it's getting information out there that we understand what's happening, and we aren't necessarily suggesting concrete solutions. I mean, we're trying to get people to the table to help craft those solutions. And there's not a formula, you know, that one fits all. And you can't just take what New Jersey has done as an example or Maryland and say, well, we'll just adapt it, you know, literally here in Illinois. We have to come up with our own unique kind of approaches and solutions. But clearly, we need to understand better what's going on. And I think that's where we're at right now. It's more that information sharing stage, beginning to develop some proposals that move us in a certain direction. There's resistance, definitely, but I think a lot of it is based on misunderstanding and lack of good information.
Hope it gets to the caller's question. We have just about a little less than 10 minutes remaining with Jerry Edelman, Executive Director of the Open Lands Project. If you'd like to join our conversation in the remaining time, you can call us around Champaign-Urbana at 333-9455 or toll-free anywhere you hear us, 800-222-9455. Another issue I wanted to, you know, just raise is the disappearance of farmland. We're seeing, you know, here in Champaign County, I think over the next few years, a battle shaping up over a particular corridor which links one of the major and growing I guess you could call it suburbs, Mahomet, with Champaign, around along Route 150. And there is a tremendous incentive if you own land along that corridor that was formerly, you know, prime farmland selling for $2,000, $3,000, maybe more an acre. Suddenly it's worth $30,000 or $50,000 or $70,000 an acre.
Yep. And there is a piece of legislation, actually, that has been approved by the House that will be going to the Senate that authorizes the purchase of agricultural conservation easements by local government. Right now, it's a little ambiguous. I mean, some would argue that they have the authority. Others say they don't. Clearly, the farmer has to be compensated. I mean, I think it's unfair to simply, you know, on a map, color an area in agricultural zone and say, well, tough, you know, that your neighbor could before, but now you can't. Yeah. And so that local legacy program I mentioned, you know, would allow a county in partnership with the municipalities to determine where the prime farmland is and to define agricultural zones, agricultural districts. There are a lot of factors that go into that. It's not just the soils. It's also the scale and, you know, a variety of things. Fragmentation is very difficult for farmers, and you start getting housing developments, you know, intermixed with farming, and then there are complaints about the smells and the traffic from the tractors and, you know, all these kinds of things. So you define your zone. And then with that, you know, we feel that there need to be programs then that allow for compensation to the farmers, willing sellers who want to remain farming, but they say, you know, we also have a resource here, and this is our investment. You know, it's our future. And Maryland has a very good program where they're acquiring those development rights and putting conservation easements on their farmland. In some cases, they're paying almost 90% of the fair market value. People say, well, why would you do that? Why wouldn't you buy the farmland outright? Mm-hmm. Well, the advantage to the purchase of development rights or of conservation easements is that, one, it remains in the private sector. It remains on the tax rolls. Public agency isn't managing it. It remains farmland, you know, very importantly. Mm-hmm. And here we are, the breadbasket, you know, of North America, one of the great breadbaskets of the world. I mean, there are economic and I think there are ethical issues, moral issues related to preservation of our farmland, but not at the expense of the individual farmer. So again, I think there are tools that are out there that we presently don't have in Illinois, and that's what we're advocating, you know, is that we develop that toolbox, you know, as completely as possible and look creatively at ways in which you can achieve multiple goals and not at the expense of the individual farmer, which really would be unfair.
Very interesting. There's a lot of these old industrial sites as well around the state. And I'm thinking of there's the former Tilton plant in Danville, which I think has been partly occupied by a new corporation and so forth. But have you worked with some of these sites? What can be done with old industrial sites that are no longer we've moved into a post-industrial age in many ways.
We have many of them along our I&M Canal Heritage Corridor because this was, you know, a very important transportation corridor. As I mentioned, where really the Industrial Revolution in the upper Midwest took place. There are complicated issues. Easy answers, you know, are buildings that don't have environmental problems, that are maybe right in the heart of the community or at the edge, that can be adapted for commercial, residential, a variety of uses. Mm-hmm. And we have many examples in the corridor of former industrial and warehousing kind of buildings that have been creatively restored and adapted, you know, for new uses. When you're dealing with industrial sites and where there are serious environmental problems, it gets much more complicated, obviously. And I think one of the things that we have to do as a society is revisit the standards that we follow. And as a conservationist, environmentalist, I'm certainly not advocating lowering standards at the cost of environmental or public safety. But right now, we basically have one standard, and everything is cleaned up as if it were, a tot lot for a kindergarten. Mm-hmm. And that doesn't make sense. And so I think we need some more flexibility, and we need to better understand the science of environmental remediation. And a lot of that is beginning to happen. Mm-hmm. Because those are huge obstacles and huge costs. Again, it needs to be done with good science and with a good understanding of the public safety and environmental dimensions. But I think that is a piece of the equation because often they're huge impediments to reuse of these properties, just the huge liability that goes with them. But they're often strategically located along transportation systems, railroads, rivers, canals, highways. They symbolize the heart and soul of the community. You know, generations of people work there, so they're very positive associations. So I think creative reuse of these properties is the answer, and we have some models, but we also have some huge issues that we haven't dealt with adequately yet.
Mm-hmm. We just have a couple minutes left, and there's much more we could talk about, but I guess I'm curious what you think about this. Do you think that there are a lot of assets out there that we don't even recognize?
Absolutely. We do a lot of work in inner-city neighborhoods in Chicago and work with community interests, block clubs, church groups, school councils, a whole range of them, bring them together at their invitation, and we almost serve as staff, but helping them inventory, you know, their assets relative to vacant land, which is liability, you know, places where houses were burned or torn down or urban renewal sites that were never developed and so forth, but to address their open space needs. And that's just kind of, for me, a metaphor for, you know, what a community often has and that they're blinded to and they haven't really looked at. I mean, here, these are sites where there's fly dumping and junk cars and rats and gang activity and symbols of despair and failure. And yet, as they start thinking about them differently, where they're located and so forth, they become assets if you can turn them around and create playgrounds and sitting parks and community gardens and so forth. And I think that every community has things like that, but we're often blinded to them. We take them for granted. And that's where the resources of a university are so key. I mean, the people like John Jekyll here and the geography faculty, who has been looking at different kinds of dimensions to the cultural landscape, helping people identify, you know, those things, not just the classic landmarks, but even the subtler things that I think that the educational community, academia, has a great role to play with community in beginning to sort of define value and to give people the tools to look afresh at where they live and figure out what it is that's really special in their community that's meaningful and that ought to be protected and enhanced and reused for future generations. So it's a complicated process, but it's an exciting one once you start on it. And you often discover things that you never imagined.
Well, very good. We'll have to leave it there. And I can just suggest for folks, if you'd like to hear more from our guest, Jerry Edelman, he will be speaking tonight at 7:30 on the third floor of the Levis Faculty Center in Urbana as part of the Millicom Lecture Series. And the title of the talk, What is a Landscape, Smart Growth, and Livability in the 21st Century? And that's free and open to the public. And Jerry Edelman, thanks very much for being here.
It was great to be here. Thank you.